How's that sound? Anybody hear me? It doesn't sound like it's on, is it?
Yeah.
Is it? Well, all righty then. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'm happy to see all of you here today, and I'm happy to be with you, so thank you for inviting me. So there was a man named Morris, and he had a wife named Esther. I'm going to turn my light on here so I know his wife's name. Morris and Esther loved to go to the county fair. Every year they went to the county fair, and they loved it. They loved all of the people and the foods and the rides and all of it. And out in the field of this county fair, there was a field and there was a helicopter. And there was a pilot that would take people on a ride on the helicopter. And every year they would go through the same thing. Morris would say, "Oh, Esther, let's go up on that helicopter ride." And every year, Esther would say, "No, we can't afford that. It's cost $50. $50 is $50, right?" So this went on year after year after year. Finally, one year, they're at the fair, and Morris says to Esther, "You know, I'm 86 years old. If I don't do it this year, I'll never get a chance to go up there." So they go over, and the pilot has overheard this conversation for a while. So the pilot has an idea. So he goes up to Morris and Esther, and he says, "I'll make you a deal. I will take you up totally free as long as you can stop this bickering and arguing about it. Totally free, but you cannot speak. I don't want to hear a word out of you." They agreed to that. Free is pretty good, right? So they get up in the helicopter, and the pilot just decides to do all of his fancy maneuvers, and he's flying around this way and that way, and he doesn't hear anything. He looks back, and they're just sitting there enjoying the ride. So he ramps it up a bit. He does a few more of these loops or whatever they do in helicopters. Looks back. They're not saying anything. So he thought, well, all right, I guess they get it for free. So they come back down, and they land, and the pilot turns around to Morris and says, "Oh, a doggy. Oh, goody, goody." Says to Morris, I'm really impressed. I didn't hear a word out of you." And Morris says, "Well, you know, I was really tempted to say something when Esther fell out, but hey, $50 is $50. So yes, $50 is $50, isn't it? There's a man named Bill Early. I love having dogs in the service. Oh, it's so cool. He can come up here if he wants. A man named Bill Early said, "If your outgo exceeds your income, then your upkeep will be your downfall." I think he was a little bit directionally challenged. So I want to talk today about some of the reasons why your outgo might exceed your income, because we don't want your upkeep to exceed your, or to become your downfall. So we all want to be abundant, right? Anybody not want to be prosperous and abundant? And really, in every area of our life, we look for that. But today I'm going to be focused a little more on the financial abundance, because that's an area where I think a lot of spiritual people have this idea that there's something wrong with wanting to be, even to be rich. And that's not really the case. There is something to be said for that. Because abundance is, of course, more than just money, but we need money in order to give our gifts to the world. Now, I'm a tree hugger. How many tree huggers do we have here? Everybody's a tree hugger. I bet that little dog likes to do things on trees, too, maybe. Yeah, same difference. Okay, well, trees do so much for us. They give us oxygen. They give us food from fruit and nuts. They give us shade. They give our little critter friends a little house to live in. They also give us paper. It gives us all kinds of paper. Now, we give a lot of power to paper, don't we? Especially when the paper is green, has a bunch of little numbers and little letters on it, and some pictures of dead presidents on them. We give this the power to make us happy. We give it the power to make us maybe desperate or maybe sad or upset that we don't have a lot of these pieces of paper, but they're really just paper, right? And we really give value to them because we believe, at least I've always believed, that somewhere there is a building that has a whole bunch of gold in it that gives these pieces of paper some kind of value. You think there is that building? There's a building. I don't know how much gold is in it or how much value it really gives these, but You know, we like to think that. But, you know, when I go in a grocery store, I get my groceries. I go up to the clerk. I give her my pieces of green paper. She gives me my groceries. I don't stand there and say, oh, gosh, I hope there's gold somewhere that's really giving this the whole value. You know, I don't even think about it. It could be monopoly money. In fact, I've often thought, wouldn't it be cool if a small town, everybody in a small town would just have an agreement, even the merchants, that every family is going to get a monopoly game. And we're going to use that money in exchange for things. Because really, money is just an exchange. It's an exchange of one thing for another. So I don't know. Maybe Franklin, maybe you can talk Franklin into doing that. I'm sure there's some monopoly games here in town. Now, a few years ago, I had gone online, and the Treasury Department had announced that it was going to be redesigning these kinds of papers. They were going to have some other people on there instead of just some of our previous presidents. In fact, one of them was Harriet Tubman. She was going to be appearing on the front of, I guess, a $5 bill or something. And Andrew Jackson was actually going to be moved to the back of that bill. He was actually a slave owner. They also were going to have pictures on these pieces of paper to honor the suffrage movement, to honor civil rights movement, and some of the other people that have done really wonderful things on our planet, in our country. Now, just a few months ago, I looked it up to see, they said at that time that we might be seeing these new bills around the year 2020. But I looked it up not too long ago, and I saw somewhere on the internet that the current administration decided they weren't going to be doing that after all. Maybe in the future it'll happen, and I think it'd be really good to have other reminders on there of people that have done really so much for our country. So I think there's an imbalance of money, and it's not just the imbalance of the pictures on the pieces of paper. I think we have an imbalance of our attitude. What are some of the attitudes some of you grew up with? Maybe you learned it from your parents about money. Anybody have some things to say about what you learned about money? Pardon me? Not good.
Doesn't grow on trees.
Doesn't grow on trees, yeah. That's right. But a lot of people have heard that they called it dirty lucre. I never knew what that lucre word meant, but it means money, I guess. But, you know, a lot of people have grown up with this idea that there's something wrong about having a lot of money. And yet, some people equate it with greed. Some people call it the root of all evil. We judge people who have a lot of it. Even if we don't know what they do with their money, there may be some people who have a lot of money, who are very rich, but they do a lot of philanthropical things with it. Hello, sweetheart. A tree, yes, a tree. So, but you know, we do judge people sometimes when they have a lot of it. Some people love money when it's theirs, but they don't love it when it's somebody else's. Or they love it when it flows into their lives, but it's a different story when it's flowing out of our lives, when we have to pay it out. So there's just a lot of things about money that's very unbalanced. And even though they are just pieces of paper or little coins, we need this in order to be comfortable. The whole purpose of money is so that we can be comfortable enough that we can then give our gifts to the world. We all came here with a purpose. We came here with something that's only for us to do. Everybody is different. Everybody has their own gift that they want to offer the world. But we can't do that if we're constantly worried about money, not having enough money. So it's really important that we have enough. How many have heard of Michael Beckwith? Anybody know Michael Beckwith? He lives in California, and he has the Agape Center, which is a huge church. It's an independent, but a New Thought kind of church. People often come to him and say, Reverend Beckwith, do I have a right to be rich? And he says to them, not only do you have a right to be, you have an obligation to be rich. Because that's the only way that we can really expand the universe. The universe is expanding, and it relies on each one of us being able to give our gifts to the world, being able to serve the purpose. We can't do that when we're playing small. So I want to offer today four keys to help us expand the financial department of our life. And God knows we need to have a bigger impact on this planet, which we can have if we don't have to worry about not having enough money. So key number one is attitude. So what do I mean by attitude? Well, let me ask a question. What is your attitude when things don't go the way you want them to, or when things don't unfold as you had hoped they would? What do you feel when things aren't working out for you?
Frustrated, yeah.
Fear.
Disappointed,
absolutely. And you know, sometimes those are the very attitudes that may block the flow of what comes into our life. I believe we need three things. I believe, first of all, we need an attitude of self-sufficiency. And what I mean by that is I think we all have an obligation to provide our own basic human needs. Most of us. I mean, of course, there are some people that do need help with that. But for the most part, if we are able and willing, we need to at least have a job to take care of our basic needs: food, shelter, water, clothing. I had a friend in Oregon. Well, I'll tell that story later. It fits in later. But, you know, some people, maybe they get divorced, but they want the ex-husband to take care of them forever, or whatever the case may be. Sometimes we have to actually get the job that is not going to make our heart sing, but it will help to support us until we do find that job that we really would truly love. But basically, I'm talking about the attitude of expectation and the attitude of non-attachment. The attitude of expectation and non-attachment kind of go together for me. It's being expecting your good, because we all are children of the one source, right? And there is good out there. There's good enough on this planet for all of us to be taken care of. And we need to know that there is a way to allow that into our lives, so we can expect that we will be taken care of financially as well as every other way. But also the attitude of non-attachment, knowing that if it doesn't turn out exactly the way I thought it was going to turn out, it's okay, because there might be something even better coming our way. So I can tell you how this unfolded in my life. This was back about 40 years ago. I was about 32 years old, and I had just divorced. My husband and I had been married for 10 years, and we decided to part ways. We had three children, and so I was going to be raising the children by myself. They were something like ages 4, 6, and 8, somewhere around there. I had no college, still don't have any college. I had only 4 years of work experience, followed by 8 years of being a stay-at-home mom. So the idea that I was going to get a great job to support my family looked a little bit bleak, but somehow I knew that something good was going to come. There were two companies. I was living in Northeast Ohio at the time. There were two companies, businesses, corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, that were the best employers in Northeast Ohio. One was called Lubrizol. It was a chemical company. And the other was TRW. So I had an interview with each one of them. I went to Lubrizol, had my interview. I felt pretty good about it. About a week later, I went to TRW, had an interview. Felt pretty good about it. So I sat at home and waited to see who was going to call and who was going to hire me. And I was expecting somebody would. I had a call one day from Lubrizol, and they said, "We had a great interview with you, and we have to tell you, you were right up there, second in line. But we gave the job to another person who had just a little bit more of what we needed for the job." Okay, now there may have been a moment of being a little disappointed, but for some reason what went through my mind was, wow, that means there's something even better coming my way. A few days later, I get a call from TRW. They said, "That was a great interview we had with you. You were right up there, number two. But we hired somebody else." And again, it's like, wow. What could be better than Lubrizol or TRW? I mean, I knew something good was coming, and it was even better. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I had to release being attached to it being either one of those. A few days later, I had a call from Lubrizol again, and they said, "Are you still looking for that job?" I said, "Yes, I am." Well, it turns out the woman they had hired had a husband with a pre-existing medical condition. And if she took the job, she would be in a new health plan, and they weren't going to cover him. So at the last minute, she had to turn down the job. So do you think I minded being second choice? No, it was a wonderful job. I worked there for 15 years. It supported me very well. I kept a roof over our heads and food on the table, raised my kids to adulthood. It was a great job. But I often look back to that time, and for me, it feels like if I had had the attitude when Lubrizol called me, if I had had the attitude like, what jerks, why would they not have given me the job? Why did they give it to her? And then the same thing with TRW. If I'd been angry with them or resentful of the other woman who got the job or whatever, I think maybe that job would not have flown into my life. I really think it was the attitude that I held about that really helped me to get that job, because I knew that something even better, if it wasn't this, something even better. Wasn't that, something even better. So I think our attitude really does direct the course of our lives. So if you're wondering why maybe things are unfolding in your life, maybe finances are not flowing in your life, really examine your attitudes, not just what you speak, because we can talk the talk, but what do you feel inside when things don't go exactly as you wanted them to? What are you holding inside? How do you feel about the person who did get the job? Are you happy for them, or do you resent them? So that's, I think if you're excited deep down, if you just know that something good is coming, that goes a long way to drawing that in through the law of attraction. You're all familiar with the law of attraction, and maybe, and how we attract things into our lives. And sometimes we have the idea that when someone else has a good fortune, that they're just lucky. Maybe someone wins a lottery and we say, oh, well, they're just lucky. They didn't deserve it. It should have come to me. It's another part of the attitude that we need to just lighten that up and let it go, because everybody's good is coming to them in the same proportion that we hold on to the attitude. And so the attitude of non-attachment is knowing or always saying this or something even better. Whatever you're trying to create in your life, end it by saying this or something even better is happening for me. The second key is desire. Have you ever heard of Catherine Ponder? Anybody know Catherine Ponder? She's a retired Unity minister and author. She wrote a lot of books on abundance, and one of the quotes from her book is, desire is God tapping at the door of your mind, trying to give you your greater good. The fact that you deeply desire something is positive proof that it has already been prepared for you, and it's waiting for you to recognize it and accept it. Our good is waiting for us to recognize it and accept it. So let's do a little bit of daydreaming here. I want you to imagine up in the sky, there's this huge warehouse. It might look like Lowe's, but on the front it doesn't say Lowe's, it says your name. So a huge warehouse with your name on it. And inside that warehouse is everything you have ever desired to have in your life. So let's say, oh, and inside there are little elves that are helpers. You might think of the Keebler elves. They're in there helping to get you whatever it is you order. So you place your order. Let's say, for instance, you want a car, a specific car. And you say, I want that car so bad. And I can, you just imagine what it would feel like with your hands on the steering wheel and smelling the leather of the seats, and imagine you're driving it. And you just are so determined you're going to have that. And those little elves up in that warehouse get so excited. And they say, she placed her order. Let's get it ready for her. And so they go find that car because it's in that warehouse because you desired it. And they bring it out, and they open the doors, and they bring the delivery truck up, they put the ramp up and start pushing your car up into that delivery truck. It's on its way to you. And the next thing you say to yourself is, oh, I'll never have that. I can't afford that. What makes me think I could ever have that? And with those words, you just canceled your order. Maybe a week later, you see a picture of that car somewhere, and you tear out the picture and you look at it and you say, I've got to have that car. I want that car, and I'm going to have that car, and I can feel what it's like, and I can smell the interior, and you're all excited, and those little elves, they get really excited again, and they get your car out and start pushing it up the ramp. And then you have an unexpected bill in the mail. And you say, why did I think I could ever have that car? I can't have that car. Nothing ever works out for me. So you've canceled your order again with your thoughts. So often we want something, but we tell ourselves we can't have it, right? So that means we placed our order and we canceled it, and we placed it and we canceled it. And we all do that. We do it over and over again. So instead of doing that, it's really important that you really focus on what you want. And I'm not just talking about material things. It could be you're looking for better health, or maybe a relationship, or improving the relationship you're in, or maybe more time and money freedom to see your grandkids, or whatever it is. So it's important that you, first of all, really decide what you want, making sure it's in harmony with who you are, and then hold your attention on it. And when you hear one of those or feel one of those thoughts going through your mind, oh, I probably can't have that, cancel that. Just say, nope, that is not true. I am capable of drawing this into my life. And just really focusing on what it is you want. Have faith that it can be yours. And make sure it's in alignment with your integrity. And then focus on it. Because we are all creating. We're creating what's in our lives. I know we don't like to think that, but we really are. With our thoughts, our words, our attitudes, our intentions. Some people are creating magnificent things in their lives, right? Some people are creating okay, mediocre things. And some of us are creating an experience of lack and limitation. It doesn't have to be that way. When you understand how to use the laws of the universe, the law of attraction and all the other laws, you can learn how to bring the things into your lives. So we have attitude, we have desire. The third key I want to talk about, up at the Creative Thought Center in Waynesville, where I go, we call it conscious giving. There's another word for it, and most people don't like this word. When you say this word, you see a glaze go over their eyes. You see a wall go up around them. What do you think the word might be? Tithing. Nobody wants to hear about that, and I'm not going to tell anyone you should tithe. Don't worry about it. I'm simply going to tell you how the universal law of circulation works. We can do with that whatever we want. But there is a book called Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh. And one of the quotes from there is, tithing is a very effective means of increasing your financial abundance. The people who tithe, in other words, who routinely give money away to others, they are people that are very clear that there's more where that came from. When we give money away, we are demonstrating that we have money. Demonstration precedes experience. In other words, you will experience what you demonstrate. If you demonstrate that you're generous, generosity is going to come back to you. It's called the universal law of circulation, and it's in effect all the time for all of us. And so, actually, we all tithe. We just don't know that we're tithing. We either tithe voluntarily or involuntarily. Everything has to circulate, right? If you're standing on a beach and you see the waves coming in, you better hope those waves are also going to go back out. They go in and out. It's a circulation. If the blood is circulating into your heart, you better hope it's going back out into your extremities, back and forth. It's a constant flow, and that's the way the whole universe works. So, and some people, the word tithe means 10%. Some people say, well, I can't do that. So maybe start with 5%. Maybe start with 1%, but make a commitment that every time money comes in, you're going to take that 1% or 2%. And give it somewhere, whether it's to your spiritual home, whether it's to a homeless person or a charity, whatever it is. When you get in the habit of that and you realize that your life is still flowing just fine, even though you're giving some of the money away. Now, that's what voluntary tithing is, when you make a commitment to give. But we give in involuntary ways as well. I have a story of both of those. My mentor is Mary Morrissey. I don't know if you've heard of Mary Morrissey, anyone? She was a minister up in Portland, near Portland, Oregon, when I lived there. She had a huge mega church, New Thought Church. And now she has Life Mastery Institute, and she trains life coaches. When she was about 20 years old, she was married, and she had just gotten through, well, a little bit later, maybe her mid-20s, she had just finished ministerial school, and she couldn't wait to get out there and start her ministry. She wanted to spread all of these teachings about the laws of the universe and how it works. Someone gave her and her husband a blackberry farm to as their income. Well, they didn't know much about blackberry farming, and it was hard work, and it wasn't her passion. Her passion was to get out there in the world and spread the message. So they did it for a while, and they just realized this is not our passion. It's too hard work. She knew that she wanted to start traveling around and speaking at different churches, Unity's, Signs of Mind, those kind of churches, wherever she could get booked as a speaker. And so they just decided we're going to have someone else take over the farm. They leased it out to someone. They paid off their car and all their expenses, and they bought a little camper. And they decided to go on the road where she could do speaking engagements. They had 4 children and 2 cats. So here they are in this little camper, she and her husband at that time, 4 children and 2 cats, and they take off. They go down through Oregon, through California. She gets speaking jobs here and there. Her husband also had some window washing equipment, so when Mary wasn't speaking a lot and they needed money, he could wash windows and tie them over. And they managed to work their way across the country. Finally, they find themselves in Texas. And it was 40 days before her next speaking engagement, which was in Florida. So they travel into Florida, and still nothing's happening. And people in Florida really didn't even want window washing, because when they see a young man, you know, a lot of retired people, they see someone coming to wash their windows, they wouldn't even open the door. So they were down to their last $3. They were in a campground in Florida, but it was still another few weeks before she was going to be speaking. They had $3 to their name. So her husband went out one morning to see if he could find a job washing windows. Mary had to get some groceries at the little camp store. So she had the 2 older children watch the 2 younger children. She walked to the camp store. And while she's walking over there, she's kind of having a conversation with God, you might say, kind of muttering to herself, you know, that she has no money. Why do we only have $3? I'm doing your work. What is it I'm not getting here? She said, I need a sign. And as soon as she said that, she looked down, and there's a shiny penny. And she picked it up. And what's it say on a penny? In God we trust. So that was her sign. So she's still walking along to the store, and she's just fussing and fuming, like, why is it we don't have enough money? We're doing your work. Why don't we? And she hears a voice in her mind. And the voice says, Mary, you tithe your time. You tithe your talents. You don't tithe your dollars. She said, of course I don't tithe my dollars. I don't have any dollars. That's the whole problem here. She hears it again. Mary, you tithe your time. You tithe your talent. You don't tithe your dollars. And she realized that that was the part of her life that was out of balance. She was freely giving of herself in so many ways. But when it came to money, she wasn't giving up because they didn't have enough. But it was the other way around. So she had the $3. She realized that if she was going to do that, she would have to take 30 cents of their last $3 and give it away. She went in the little camp store, and she bought some milk and some split peas so she could make soup. And on her way back, there was a little open chapel. It was a Christian campground, and there was a chapel there with a little donation basket. And she decided to put in her 30 cents in there. Now, 30 cents doesn't sound like a lot, but back then it was, especially when you have so little. So she got back to the camper, and she starts fixing dinner. And her husband walks in, and he said, guess what happened? I just got a window washing job. They wanted me to do the whole place. And I made $80. That was a lot of money then. So she said, well, guess what I did today? I gave 30 cents away of our $3. Because I decided to tithe. I decided I'm not going to do this alone anymore. I am going to tithe, see what happens. And fortunately, he agreed with her. So they took $8 of the $80 he just made. They sent it ahead to the church she was going to be speaking in a few weeks. And that was the last time she ever decided to do it alone. She has always tithed. She has made several multi-million dollar businesses in her life, and she's very abundant. So that's voluntary, and it works. Now, I have an experience in my own life of involuntary, because, you know, whenever we don't give freely, somehow the universe manages to take it anyway, somehow. So this was back in when I was first divorced and had that job with Lubrizol. This was actually before I got the job. And I was working for 15 years for Lubrizol. Now, right after my divorce, we had a house that I was living in to raise the kids, but it was still in my name and my husband's. And he asked me one day if I would be willing to let him use the house as collateral for a business he was going to start. He and another man and that man's wife, they were all part of this. So there were four of us. And being a blonde, I said, okay, and I signed all these papers without reading any of that fine print because I trusted. Well, somehow that business fell apart within a year. And all of the equipment was taken by the bank and everything. Anyway, the final debt that was due was $46,000. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to pay a fourth of that. But I didn't. I actually had to pay the whole thing because the other three all filed for bankruptcy. So there was $46,000 that I had to pay in addition to raising the kids and all of that. And it took me many, many years, but I did it. But a few months ago, I decided to figure out the 15 years that I worked for Lubrizol. I calculated approximately what I had made over those 15 years, and I took 10% of that, and what do you think it came out to? About $46,000. So I tithe, it's just that I didn't do it voluntarily. When I didn't give it out, the universe says, okay, we need your money to flow out too. So here we go. So that's an example of involuntary tithing. Because, you know, some people will get a paycheck and they'll cling to it and they'll dole out a little bit for their rent or mortgage and dole out a little for their utilities and food, but they cling to it. And if they're not giving any of it freely, then that's when maybe the dishwasher breaks, the kid needs braces, there's an unexpected bill in the mail. So somehow they have to give it out. It would be so nice if we could just, when money comes in, say, wow, I am so grateful I get to keep 90% of this, or whatever the percentage is, and then give the 10% away. There's joy that comes with that. And when we're living in joy, we become automatically attracting more things that give us joy into our lives. So the fourth key is positive affirmations. Some people are really great with words. I mentioned a friend of mine in Oregon, a couple that I knew up there, and the woman was very good at saying all of these wonderful affirmations. Money is flowing into my life. I am so abundant. And she just had wonderful words. It was beautiful, and it's very important to do that. However, she and her partner or husband, they never had their own place to live. They either did house-sitting or they would ask friends if they could stay in their house for a while and then somebody else's house. They never had a car. They would either get rides with people or borrow people's car. And they were not, of course, able to financially give because they didn't have any money. And yet, all of these affirmations that she said sounded great, and it's easy to say things. But I realized that inside, she had a little bit of self-talk, a little voice in there saying, I don't have enough, I don't have enough, I don't have enough, I'm broke, I don't have money. That's what her self-talk was saying. So it's fine to say things out loud, to use your I am statements, I am abundant. But it's really dependent on what's inside. What Conversations with God calls the sponsoring thought. You either have a sponsoring thought of abundance or a sponsoring thought of lack and limitation. So I'm not telling anyone that you should tithe. I'm just saying this is how the universe works. And as we gradually get used to it, even if it's just a little bit, maybe you see a homeless person and you give them $1 or some change and you realize your life didn't fall apart. And then maybe you give a little bit more. And then gradually, more and more. And you see. And then one day you may get a check in the mail from someone that borrowed from you 10 years ago and just remembered to pay it back. You know, little things like that start happening. So the last key is really about words. Not just the words we use, because the words I am, Just as we heard in that song, I think, the I am is who we are. That's really an expression of what's in us. We have the I am presence within us. But I think there's also something about the energy we put into our words, especially the energy of enthusiasm and the energy of gratitude. You put those together, and I call them gratithusiasm. It's not a word, but it is now. So I think that when we put the energy into our I am statements, it really starts the flow of abundance. It jump starts it. It was around the year 1999, I think. I was living in Boulder, Colorado. I knew that my time was kind of coming to an end there. I didn't know why. I didn't know where I was supposed to go. But I happened to be going, I went to Mile High Church in Denver, which is a huge church, Signs of Mind Church. I was sitting there, and I was so moved by the minister, Dr. Roger Teal, the main minister there. When I came out of the church, I shook his hand and told him how much I enjoyed his sermon or his talk, and I started across the parking lot to get in my car, and I had a lump in my throat, and I could tell there were some tears that were going to come any minute now. I got in my car, and I sat there. Everybody else had left the whole parking lot. I was the only one out there. I sat there probably for about an hour. I knew the change was coming into my life, but I didn't know what it was. But I knew I was ready for it. So I had this little conversation with God in that car that day, and I let God know exactly what I wanted. And I was crying, and I was yelling, because I knew no one could hear me. Probably the neighbors did, but I didn't care. And I used all of my statements. I am going to be among people like him, referring to Dr. Roger, because I looked at him as one of the shakers and movers of the planet, one of the people that are truly inspiring a lot of people. And I wanted that. I wanted to be that. So I told God, you know, take me wherever you want me. I don't know what you want me to do, but take me there, and I'm going to be around people like him. I'm going to be on a first-name basis with them. I'm going to be in their homes. I'm going to be friends with them. I'm going to be one of them. And I said this over and over and over again. It's louder than I'm saying it right now. I put so much energy into those words, so much enthusiasm. And then finally, I calmed down. I drove back to my apartment in Boulder, and about a week later or so, I decided, okay, I'm just going to get in my car, and I'm going to drive until I find that place where I am meant to be. I do a lot of that. I call it a clarity quest. I just take off in my car with my camping gear and just drive. So I drove across Colorado and down all the way to Southern California and stayed a few places here and there, camped in some of the national parks, worked my way all the way up through California. Nothing was becoming clear yet, but I knew I was on a clarity quest. I got into Mount Shasta, and I thought, maybe I'll get into Mount Shasta, which is in Northern California, and I'm going to hear bells and whistles, and that's going to be the place. Well, I got to Mount Shasta, and it's like, I'm not feeling anything yet, but you show me. I just asked to be guided. I followed the front of my car because I know that when I ask my guides or my source for anything, I darn well better listen to it. So I kept driving, and I drove into Oregon, which is just a few miles up from Mount Shasta. And I'm coming down Siskiyou Summit, which is a mountain pass, and I see Ashland, Oregon. It's like, okay, I think this is it. I saw a little lake there. I camped by the lake. I walked around the town, and I just knew this was where I was going to be. I have no clue what I was going to do once I got there, but I knew it. And now, the first year, I did mostly caregiving and things like that, but then the perfect job just dropped into my lap, and I became a personal assistant to a best-selling author. I've been with him for almost 19 years now, although now it's from a distance, but for the first 17 years, I was there in Ashland and worked for him. I always look back to that moment when I was in my car in the parking lot at Mile High Church, and the energy I put into my I am statements. I think that was what jump-started the flow of abundance in my life and the flow of energy to draw to me the job that I really wanted. And through working for Neil Donald Walsh, I got to meet many other best-selling authors and wrote a book of my own, and a whole bunch of things unfolded for me. It's like doors opened for me once I got there that were not opening before. So I just really feel that when we put our energy and our enthusiasm into the words that we are stating for ourselves, that that really is what jumpstarts it. I often, when I'm in my car and I'm driving on the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is a lot, I'm always saying these kind of statements enthusiastically. And that's what I want for all of you. How many would like to have more of anything in your life? More abundance, more health, more successful relationships? Two of you, three, okay. I think really deep down we all want that. We all want to live our life fully. So that when we come to the end of our life, we know that we did what we came to do and we lived a full life. So I would love it if you would repeat some things after me. And how are you going to repeat them? Enthusiastically. All right. So repeat after me. There is a power in me. There is a power in me that is greater than my circumstances. Greater than my circumstances. I now invite that power to co-create with and through me. My deepest desires.
My deepest desires.
So that I am free.
So that I am free.
To share my gifts with the world.
To share my gifts with the world.
I live my life with integrity.
I live my life with integrity.
And I go forth today.
I go forth today.
With a spirit of gratitude.
With a spirit of gratitude.
Enthusiasm.
Enthusiasm.
And expectancy. I live my life with gratithusiasm.
I live my life with gratithusiasm.
All right, and so it is. Thank you. It's enthusiastic.
Enthusiasm. I'll get there. Here we go. We'll get you fixed.
Yes, I'm getting unretrofitted now, huh?
Unretrofitted.
There's that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay.
I'll turn this off. Oh, you turn it off, you blessed soul.